Make It Right, the manufacturing podcast.
Welcome to the Make It Right podcast. I'm Janet Eastman. Today, we continue our conversation with Neil Dillette, who has more than 30 years as both a consultant and practitioner, leading continuous improvement programs in the industry and for several billion-dollar brand supply chains. Last week on the show, we talked about the goal of a continuous improvement program and how you manage it across the supply chain. This week, we'll discuss the ROI of continuous improvement, how to bring around the skeptics, and how to get all the teams working together. And that's where we pick up our conversation.
The way that getting all these teams to work together is you got to have the right key performance indicators in place, and you have to have a common set of objectives. So obviously, when a consumer goes to the store with a list of 30 items to buy, they want to find all 30 on the shelf. So the objectives need to be clear all the way back in the supply chain, whether it's in the sales office or it's in the transportation or distribution area, or it's back at the manufacturing plants. Every node along the supply chain needs to have the critical measures that are linked to the consumer getting to what they want. So in a plant, a key performance indicator is how effectively are you running your equipment, which is then tied to when you have a production schedule on a daily basis, are you making what you are supposed to make every single day? That's very critical so that when the product's made, it goes into inventory, and when customers order it, they're able to pull the inventory from your distribution center into theirs and then eventually into the stores so that you always have the correct inventory in the location. So again, they have to have the right objectives and key performance indicators in place to make sure that they are tied along the supply chain. The other thing that's really important is, since a supply chain has multiple nodes, I often use multifunctional teams to solve. So to solve the product flow, it's typical to say, if I've got a distribution issue of getting product to the store, I would get somebody from store operations together with transportation, with distribution center, and also the manufacturer's distribution center. So all the players that are in the execution of the flow of the product, they're all together so that they can understand where any issues exist. Instead of people saying, well, it was okay when it left my location, and then you throw it over the wall, and then there's a miss in the handoff of the product. So you have to use multifunctional teams to solve those issues, because the issues cut across multiple organizations, and a single individual organization cannot solve these types of problems all by themselves. And also, the last point I'd make is, whenever teams or organizations are in a supply chain, they need to understand how the output of their work is accepted by the downstream organization. Because if you have defects in your work, those defects are going to show up in the downstream organization, and it's going to cause issues right away for them to utilize your output.
So that makes complete sense, but how common is it? I mean, you talk about the multifunctional teams and how, you know, the impacts down, the results that push downstream. How common is it that people in the industry do act that way and deal with those multifunctional teams and look down the supply chain?
Well, based on my past experiences of working with manufacturers and retailers, whenever I've done improvement projects, the use of multifunctional teams is a new concept. It's fairly, you know, when you think about it, the fact that a work process cuts across multiple organizations, you have to have the people that participate in the work process in those organizations to sit down and solve the problem. And typically when I've done that, it's very easy to solve the issue because everybody that's involved is sitting right there at the table. Mm-hmm. And so there's no hiding what the issue is, and the solutions typically are pretty straightforward and easy to affect.
So how long does the whole process take? Like, I know you said continuous improvement's never ending, and you know, you generally do a look see and readjust every year or every 6 months sometimes, but how long does it, if you say, okay, we're going to start this continuous improvement program, how long does it actually take to get the process rolling?
Well, I always tell people that I use the analogy of a snowball rolling downhill. To get continuous improvement started in a company, it starts very small, and then it starts to gain traction and momentum. So as people are doing the work, they're seeing the benefit, they're like, we need to be utilizing more of this across the rest of our company. And so what they do is then they start to get others engaged in the activity. To successfully have continuous improvement integrate into your culture, it could take years. But the thing is that you could do trainings and workshops immediately and see immediate benefits and see a great return on your ROI and your cost just as you get started. So it's something that even though it takes a while to become ingrained, that's typically a function of the number of people that are in a company. Whenever I've worked with larger companies, a project improvement team could be 6 to 8 people. Mm-hmm. And when you think that a company has 800 people in it, it takes a while to touch 800 people. And that's why it takes a while to get that continuous improvement program as a part of their culture.
Right. So I'm sure that you've been tasked with doing a continuous improvement program where people have been skeptical because, you know, similar programs have been tried and they haven't worked and whatnot. How do you bring people around to this idea that, yeah, it takes a really long time to get this thing going, but it's the snowball and it will work if we just keep rolling? How long does it take to get those people on side?
It's a great question because I've actually been in at the start of a 3-day workshop where we were doing introductions, and one of the individuals, as they introduced themselves, said, "I've done this 3 times with other people and it never worked." And that was their introduction. So I was like, oh, "Okay, great," but yeah. His comment was accurate. And it didn't bother me at all because it's exactly how he felt. But what I told him was, at the end of 3 days, if you still feel like you're in the same place, I said, I'd be very surprised because I've always seen people's, if you do it the correct way, you always get those people to turn around because you're using data and you're using issues that they deal with every day. And when they see what the root cause is and how it can be fixed, that's what gets people to turn around. So I always tend to start with a pilot project or a pilot team to demonstrate the tools that you're going to use. And I always want to make it on a highly visible topic or issue. And leadership has to be involved. So the skeptical person, I would want them to be on the pilot team because those are the people that they tend to push back the most. But once they have seen the result, those are the people that others will follow because they're like, if you can convince this person that this is a great thing to do, then it must be good. And so I always start with a pilot execution, and you have to get leadership to be involved because they're the decision makers. They're the one that decides whether the program goes or not. And if leadership commitment is not there, your program is going to be over before it's done. I've personally been, when I first was trained by Toyota consultants, we were very grassroots or bottom up execution. Leadership was still wanting to be convinced that this is the right direction to go. And we had lots of people who were out doing the work, getting great results, but we ended up having to restart the program after a couple of years because leadership was not bought in. That's why I always stress that leadership has to be committed and leading the charge and in the pilot projects, because those people are the ones that if they believe in it, they're going to maintain it. Otherwise, like I said, it's going to be a lost cause.
Right. Well, if there's a great financial impact of a program like this, that if there is great ROI at the end of it, then leadership is likely to follow. There is great ROI, isn't there?
Yes, there is. And it's important that people pick the right things to work on. I've worked on projects before where they targeted the right, for example, I was on a damage reduction execution across the supply chain, and the existing loss is $2 million. And after 6 months, the loss had been reduced by over $1 million. And this was, we did a 2-day workshop, identified the issues. It took them 6 months to execute, and they saved $1 million. And it basically was, the return on investment was, infinite when you think about how much you'd have to spend to save $1 million in 2 days. Whenever projects are individually executed, a typical ROI that I see very commonly is about a 20-to-1. So if they're spending $1 on it, they're getting $20 back. And as I look at projects for people to do, I always want to know, as they're saying, here's what I want to work on, one of my first questions is, what's this worth? Because I've done projects before where people pick their pet project, and after we completed it, the savings weren't that great. And so my learning has been, I want to know what it's worth before we ever do it, because it's a waste of time. Plus, leadership's looking at the investment of people's time, and they're asking, why did we pick that? And, I wouldn't have picked that idea. So it's important that when you get started, picking pilot projects is important, because you want to pick ones that are going to have, that can be done quickly, have an high impact on results, and will get people excited about doing the work.
Mm-hmm. So what does the consumer get out of continuous improvement? Like, I know we talked about the store shelves are always like 90% full, and you can usually find what you want at the grocery store, but what else does the consumer get?
Yeah, the consumer, when they're buying a brand or a product, they want great quality at a low price, and they want to buy it when they want to buy it. And so by investing in a continuous improvement program, when I was in a manufacturing plant, every year we had a 97 index on budget, which meant that if our budget was $10,000, next year our budget's $9,700. So our goal was constantly to reduce our manufacturing expenses, which then would drive down the cost to the consumer, which would make our product more favorable. Because our focus was always to deliver high quality, but we wanted to do that as cost effectively as possible, because that just fuels the individual's purchasing power so that they can buy more product because it's less expensive.
Mm-hmm. And I guess at the end of the day, I mean, the consumer is everybody's boss, right? Because if they're not buying, you're not selling.
Yeah, it's exactly right. And you can read in the papers and the stories all the time where lack of quality or cost is really turning consumers off and forcing them to make different decisions, which hurts your business significantly.
Mm-hmm. Neil, very, very interesting conversation. Thank you so much for your insights today. I really appreciate it.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Janet. I appreciate the time.
My pleasure. Neil Dillette is a senior consultant at Simpactful, where he provides his expertise on continuous improvement. That is our show for this week. Thanks very much for listening and sharing the Make It Right podcast with others in the industry. I'm Janet Eastman. We'll see you next week.